Does anybody feel less arrogant? I never asked that before. It is an antidote to that, though. Alright, so we're going to do, we have children with us. And so we're going to do the prayers. And it's kind of interesting. Gish Gelick loves to have the children here to do the mantras, particularly because, anyway, what I've heard him say is, and I think it's probably some truth, the children are so much more pure than we are. So when they say the mantras, they're more powerful. So it's kind of nice to have them here to be part of that. And then they'll go off and do their thing in a minute. We're not going to do the prayers in Tibetan this week. I don't speak Tibetan, so I'm just going to stick with the English version of it. So we'll do on page 34 and page 35 all the way down, and then we'll skip over, because I think we like to do the mantras with the kids. We'll skip over and do the Almighty on the bottom of page 37, our Chinrezig mantra and Green Tara mantra. So we'll do that at the end of the prayer. So we have. Okay, so I mentioned this earlier. The motivation for taking refuge and generating bodhicitta, rather than have these be some sort of, like we're parroting these prayers because, you know, they're here. We're not really thinking about what we're doing. We need to at least pause for a moment and try to remember why we're taking refuge and why we're generating bodhicitta. And the things to reflect on, the first one is the easiest way to say it is dread. It's like having some sense of dread of what the future is going to be like with the kind of mind that we have. You know, we can't control our minds. We can't. I mean, you might think you can. Sit down for 1 minute and try to focus on your breath. Goes every which way. So living a life in this process of uncontrolled causation that we call samsara can only be problematic. Only be problematic. So we have to have some sense of that, and that's called, and when we have that, we have some sort of dread, like, wow, I need some help. I've got a problem here. And then the other motivation that's helpful is a sense of confidence, sometimes called faith, that the three jewels, the Buddhas, the enlightened beings, their teachings, the realizations of the teachings, and the spiritual community, and our ability to become a Buddha, to realize the teachings, and to be part of that spiritual community. So we're taking refuge in all of that. We have confidence that that's a valid source of refuge. So if we have that, plus a little bit of compassion for ourselves and others, come on in, guys, have a seat. That's all good. That's all good. And so we want to reflect briefly on those things before we start doing the prayers of four measurables. So the refuge in bodhicitta, and the four measurables are immeasurable love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And then the seven limb prayer, we'll read that. And that's, again, very powerful prayer. It has a lot of meaning if you understand what it means. And then a mandala offering is like offering up everything in Crabtree Valley, you know, for the teachings. Like all the wonderful things in the world you would be willing to offer for teachings that could help you solve your problems. So, you know, Lama Yeshe used to say, just imagine Walmart, offering everything in Walmart. But, you know, that doesn't do it for me. But, you know, just imagining offering everything that's good to the enlightened beings to get their teachings like that. Okay. All right, so I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly, by my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly, by my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha fill and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamniyata Yami. So Aaron, I'm going to let you lead the mantras. Where are you? Do you know the tune? Yeah. Let's do Om Mani Padme Hum, because I have a different tune and I can't remember the one they do here. Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. Now Tara. Do tari do re so ha, Om tari do tari do re so ha. Om tari tu tari tu 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 re so ha. Okay, anything else? Children, and it sure beats video games and watching Hannah Montana and the Disney Channel. That's my story. So let's do a little meditation to kind of get everybody, at least get me settled down. I don't really have anything else to say after the first group wore me out. I'm going to have to... Yeah, I might need some caffeine, but yeah. So sit, anybody just really new to meditation, never done it before? No? Okay, good. So sit up straight, and bring your awareness to your breath, whatever you choose. And you can also count, by the way. You know, Geshe has taught the nine-round breathing many times. You could do that. Just don't make a lot of racket when you do it, but that'll settle the mind. Or you can count the breath, like exhale. Wait a minute. Yeah. Exhale and inhale is one. Exhale and inhale silently, two, up to 21. It's not easy to do, but that's one way to keep your mind hooked on something. And then, of course, when you get distracted, which inevitably we will, the crucial thing is not to let your mind just go on and wander, but to bring your mind back. So if you can bring your mind back again and again, then you will have meditated. If all you do is daydream, you will have daydreamed, but you wouldn't have meditated. So we'll do the placement meditation first on the breath, and then a little bit of analytical meditation later. I want to check your reason for coming today to Kadampa Center. Like, why are you here? You could have been in bed. You could be, like, playing video games or watching TV or maybe doing something completely different, but you chose to come here. So what is it that What is your reason for coming today? What's your motivation for coming? Without even talking to anybody, I already know I'm psychic. I can tell you exactly why you're here. Because this is what runs sentient beings, human beings, living beings, 24/7. And whatever story we tell ourselves, we don't want to suffer and we want to be happy. It's that, it comes down to that. We don't want to suffer and we want to be happy. And everything we do 24/7 is for that reason. And sometimes it doesn't look very pretty, but that's what motivates living beings, is the desire for happiness and the desire to be free of and avoid suffering. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Not a bad thing. And there's a motivation that's more magnanimous, that's more powerful. Like if you want to go someplace, you want the most powerful engine, you know, in your jet, so to speak, or in your boat. If you want to get from point A to point B, and the most powerful engine for spiritual realization is one that focuses, you know, instead of me, I want to be happy and I want to suffer, which is, again, valid. It's focused on others. Yeah. How can I help others? What can I do for others? You know, I woke up this morning to get dressed and eat breakfast and come to Gadamba Center for others. How many of us had that thought? I want to develop myself spiritually so I can help others. I dedicate my life as much as I can to others. So, there's, you know, our spiritual teachers say that that attitude of striving for perfection, even though it sounds like, impossible, sounds so out there, but we strive to purify our minds of these negative habitual patterns, call it what you want, karma, but that's what it is. We want to purify these, eliminate these destructive habitual patterns that drive us into the ground so many times, again and again. We want to eliminate those or diminish them, and we want to develop positive qualities of mind, like love and compassion and kindness and generosity and a sense of freedom, a sense of joy. That's what we want. So we can do this through a systematic retraining of the mind. So we strive for the supreme happiness of enlightenment, not just for ourselves, but so that we can help others. That's said to be the rocket fuel, the strongest, the strongest motor to get us from where we are now, whatever that looks like, to the highest conceivable happiness. And it's something that we can do with our mind. We have that potential. So as much as we can, we try to align our thinking this way. And at least have that motivate the next hour. Think, I'm going to do what I can to develop my mind in a positive way so I can help my family, my coworkers, just my community. Forget about all sentient beings. Let's just talk about the people that you're going to be around today and tomorrow like that. Make it real for you. So does anybody know what I'm supposed to talk about today? I don't think it was put on the list or that's okay. I told
Dharma for a happy life.
No, yeah, I know. When I told Sarah Brooks, I knew she wasn't gonna write it down. But anyway, it's like I'll give you some clues here if I can get my gadget to work. It probably won't work. This is so a couple of weeks ago I was in New York listening to the Dalai Lama, and they had long lines because the security was hard to get through. So then I went up to several friends, people that I've known for that have been into the Dharma for like 20 plus years, and I bugged them. I said, "I'm gonna make you infamous here." So here we go. Let's see who this is first. If you can't hear it, I'll put it up to here. Oh, shucks. This is Lauren Ladner, who has been here. He wrote a book on Buddhism and compassion. Hang on a minute. Technology will prevail. It says I'm connected. Come on, Jill, help me out here. Oh, here we go. This might work now. Okay.
Things are finicky.
I know.
There you go.
See, it didn't work there.
Turn your volume.
It is. I think.
You're on silent. Does that make a difference?
How do you know? Maybe.
Dr. Lauren Ladner, famous author and good friend. Is it okay for Buddhists to have...
Can you hear that?
Give me
this is Lauren.
I think for sure, as long as it's compassionate trust.
You can figure it out.
It didn't work either. So he said... I said, is it okay for Buddhists to have fun? And he says, for sure, but don't forget compassion. That was the message. This thing worked a few minutes ago.
This is Dr. Lauren Ladner, famous author and good friend. Is it okay for Buddhists to have fun, Lauren? Give me the 25 words or less.
I think for sure, as long as it's compassionate fun.
Compassionate fun. Okay, give me a little bit more.
Compassionate fun.
Fun that's not hurting others. Okay, maybe that's sharing your joy with other people.
Okay.
That's pretty good.
Thank you.
All right, this is Bernard. Bernard's been he's been like 40 years plus. He's been here before. He's a very nice man.
Happiness is fun.
So, bliss is the best fun. Can Buddhists have fun? And
okay.
You said,
I said, if you can, the generation of bliss is incredible happiness. Mixing that with emptiness, I mean, what better fun could you possibly have with life?
Amen, I like it. That was Bernard.
Bliss.
Knows.
Yeah, bliss. But we're not there yet, probably. But Bernard said bliss is... What could be more fun than bliss, Enlightened beings have total bliss all the time. I like that. Now, Wendy Cook is... Nick Rubish's wife, been practicing for decades, and they run Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive. So I caught Wendy, and I said, hey, Wendy.
This is Wendy Cook, longtime Dharma student and Tantrika Dakini, all the time. Anyway, this question is, Buddhism seems to be against fun or anti-fun, or there's no... You can't have fun if you're a Buddhist. Would you comment on the... What is your response?
Enjoy with wisdom.
Enjoy with wisdom. That's easy. Quick and...
That was Robbie.
Long
All right, so that's it. Anyway, Wendy's very wise lady too. So you know, you get lots of different answers from people. And you know, for example, Lama Yeshe. I do think people sometimes come to spiritual practice and think, well, I've got to give up everything. You know, all you know, my friends, my parties, my you know, my vacations. You know, they go too far. They go too far. You know, it's like Buddhism is about the middle way, isn't it? Free of the extremes. So, giving up everything, for example, and I mean, if somebody's considering to be a monk or a nun, that's fine. But you know, I've been around this Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, for many years, and I've seen a lot of people who have given up everything to become monastics, and some of them have been able to keep their vows, and others, the vast majority, have not. You know, they've given their vows back because it was too big a leap, you know? But, you know, to give up the family life and stuff like that. So it's, so the conversation today was really about, well, let me see if I can, I don't need this thing anymore. Really about trying to, and it's a discussion that I expect other people to help out with, because there's a lot of different things to talk about, and we're not going to get through it all today. Excuse me. But these are the notes from last time. I think I decided to leave them up here. Girls just want to have fun. Who was that? Cindy Lauper. Yeah, I put CL over there. Then, I'm bored. I heard this yesterday. I'm not having fun. HB, Hannah Brown, 11-year-old daughter. Then Lama Zopa, you ask him, like, you know, what's fun? What's the purpose of life? And the Dalai Lama and Guru Shakyamuni Buddha, and he says, the purpose of life is to lead all sentient beings, living beings, to supreme enlightenment. That's fun. That's what Lama Zopa would say is really fun. To be a Buddha and be able to leave a... And that's total bliss. You know, that's just total bliss. Then, JB, whose name will not be... I won't tell you who he is, but we'll come back to this one many times. I heard this standing around a fire about 3 or 4 years ago, and he said, we were just talking about stuff, and he said, isn't that what it's all about? Having as much fun as you can while you can. He's talking about life now. He said, isn't that what life's all about? Have as much fun as you can while you can. So I thought about that, and I agree with him. But I think we have to talk about this. We can't just say that's, you know, the way it is. I don't... You know, at one level I agree with him, and I don't know what his motivation is. Do you mind if I use that chair? Thank you. Yeah, good. Thank you. So anyway, I'd like to hear some definitions of fun. There are a lot of fun-loving people here. Buddhism used to attract people that were just semi-depressed and wanted to be in dark rooms, but now there's a lot of fun people.
Some of us just fell around.
All right, go ahead.
I'm just passing the mic.
Oh, okay. Well, talk about fun. Talk about your anything you want to. Yeah,
okay,
your reaction
sure.
To.
I have the microphone. I just turned it on. Can you hear? Okay. For me, fun is being outside, enjoying nature.
Uh-huh.
That's fun for me.
Okay. Being outside and enjoying nature. Okay.
I think people think what fun is doing what they want to do, when they want to do it, and how they want to do it.
Somebody, Mark Twain said that, I think.
We get down to brass tacks. It's really... We don't think X is having fun if it's doing dishes or sweeping or having a fight, but we might think going in nature and having it, going to a movie is fun because we just want to do that.
Yeah.
So if we redefine later what fun is, but it's really what we want to do when we want to do it.
Okay. Yes.
I think fun has a lot to do with my mood. Because I could be doing anything I want to do, but still not be having fun.
Right.
So it's a state of mind rather than any particular
activity.
Situation or activity.
Yeah. Well, let's say your particular activity was going into nature. Was that what you said? How long do you usually go into nature? How long does it take for you to be in nature before you're having fun? A minute, okay. Okay, well, if you did that 24/7 for like a month, would you still be having fun? You'd be in nature.
I guess really, maybe I didn't use the word. Maybe what I'm talking about isn't quite, you can't define it as fun as in just maybe peace of mind.
Yeah, so the activity itself, you know, over time is going to get boring, if not downright offensive, you know? The thing that, like eating a good meal, you go, oh, I had a really good meal last night. I went, oh, this is great. This is nice. You know, but if I'd have kept eating, I would have gotten sick. It was fun up until a certain point, then it became like a problem. So kind of like you said, attitude is everything. That's the chief determinant of whether any particular activity is going to bring us pleasure. Now, I'm equating, you got to be careful here because I'm shifting words on you. But pleasure most time equals fun, wouldn't you say? Pleasure, fun, yeah. All right.
Oh, yeah, what I was going to say is that it's when I'm absorbed in an activity and don't notice the rest of the world around me, and it could be writing a program, which is what I do professionally. Sometimes that really feels like work, but sometimes, you know, it feels like, you know, I'm engaged in doing it. Sometimes it's painting a wall at home, or whether it's cleaning or out doing a hike.
Mm-hmm.
It's when I'm absorbed to the point that I don't notice anything else except the activity that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Somebody over here. So again, it's not, because sometimes you've done your programming and hated it, right? So it's the state of mind that you bring to that experience that makes it fun, pleasurable, if we're going to use those terms interchangeably. Yes?
I think it was just complimenting what she said, that when Geshe-la said so many times, joyfully doing, if you're going to do something, doing it with joy,
right.
That is what can be fun. You can be washing your dishes and having fun because you're doing with joy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a state of mind, mostly.
State of mind, okay. Yeah.
That's along the same lines as what I was thinking more analytically. It's not really what you're doing, it's how you're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
I think that's pretty much to agree with what everybody else says, that I think if you're present with whatever you do in any moment can be fun. Anything can be fun if you're 100% present. Even washing the dishes can be fun if you're 100%
mm-hmm.
present with it. And walking can be fun if you're to go to the nature, and it's fun because your nature kind of forces us to be present, to be watching the leaves and the trees and flowers. That's the fun part of it, because we are mostly to be present at that moment instead of doing something else.
Mm-hmm. So I got a question. So I've heard it enough times that I decided to have it, you know, and I asked these three people at this meeting. I've heard it so many times, and even, you know, even people in other, like Christianity, they say, you know, people get turned off because it looks like it's, you know, it's like no fun. I can't have fun anymore. What is it about, I mean, where did that come from? What do you think? Why do you think people think that we can't have fun? Yeah.
I think people associate giving up things with lack of fun. Mm-hmm. You don't want to give up things, you want to get things. And that's kind of what we're taught since we're kids, is to go out and get things, get as much as you can.
Right. So giving up, for example, give me some examples of what you might have to give up to have fun. I mean, to when you come here, what might you have to give up?
I don't really give up anything.
Give up money? Did you say money? Oh, you didn't give up anything. Good. Well, hey, okay. Go ahead.
But, okay, I'll say one more thing. About having fun, I've kind of learned that it's not so much what you're doing, but it's who you're doing it with and having the right attitude while you do it.
And so, what?
I was just saying, it's not what you do, but who you do it with. Because you can do something with, you know, the right people or the wrong people, and that makes all the difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Right here.
To me, personally, having fun, there's a big element of personal importance that gets in the way of having fun, either when you're doing dishes, brooming, or, you know, taking a shower. So, you know, if you take things, if I stop taking things too personal, then, you know, suddenly you're singing and, I don't know, it's like a joke. Mm. You know, it's light. It becomes mm-hmm. lighter, what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And, yeah. With regard to giving up, like when taking the lay vows, a lot of people tend to have an issue of giving up alcohol because how am I going to have fun doing certain social situations, which I've always, alcohol is always complimented. Like going to a football game, New Year's Eve. But if you ask any alcoholic, they'll tell you that their life, you know, exponentially improved once they gave up alcohol. So it's that long term of understanding that once you give up the attachment for alcohol, those events are going to be so much more fun than they were when they were attached to alcohol.
Uh-huh.
And then the other thing I think when going to compassion is it's like I can't do the self-indulgent fun. So if I want to sit in my house and watch Netflix all day, but now you're telling me I can't because that's too self-indulgent, I have to go out and help people. When I coordinated a volunteer program, that's what people would say is, oh my gosh, I volunteer and I had the most fun I've ever had on a Saturday. That's so much better than if I sat in my house and did the self-indulgent Netflix all day. But it takes that first step. You have to do it 5 times before it really becomes, you know, ingrained in part of your life, and that you truly know that that's more fun than the self-indulgent fun.
Right. Well, that's what Lauren Ladner, the first guy, he said. You know, do what you do, but do it with wisdom and compassion, and then it becomes Dharma practice, not just fun, but Dharma practice, which I think, as you know, as a spiritual community, it's not just about having fun, but it's also, I mean, this is for me important to you know, it's like, I know I don't have a lot of time left on this planet, so none of us really do, we don't know, but there's a finite amount of time, so we want to make as much of a positive impact on our karmic continuum as we possibly can. So how can we take every moment of this life and have fun, but also have it be the cause for future happiness? That is, infuse that moment of fun with wisdom, with compassion. I think that's something worth thinking about. Yeah, one other person back here. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So I think the reason why most people would give up is because the routine kicks in. So they start doing things, and then they think about the outcome. After a while, it becomes a routine. They no longer enjoy what they're doing. Instead of doing that, instead of thinking about the result, they should just enjoy what they're doing, and then they can have fun forever.
Yeah. Let's see. We got one more, and then I'm gonna say a little bit.
It's like cleaning out a horse barn. If you're out alone shoveling out the stalls, it's a real drag. It's not fun. But when you have three or four people next to you, you're all shoveling the stalls, you have the smell of the manure and the grain and the horses, and you can laugh and talk. And then all the manure, you know, goes to the garden, so next year you have a better garden. And that's fun. But being alone, it's not fun.
Yeah. Okay. So, thank you for... let's see, Andre wants to say one thing, and then I think we'll... I need to say a few things. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just thinking. I think, for myself, when I first started on this path, and I was doing the Discovering Buddhism class, two things, because of my misunderstanding of what they were, really, really scared me. And one was renunciation. This whole idea of just giving up everything. I didn't understand what renunciation really was, and so that really, really scared me because I didn't want to give up everything. You know, I wanted to hold on. I like to dance. I like song. I like music. I like the things that bring me pleasure and bring me joy. And so I had an idea that renunciation meant that I had to give up all of that. And that's not what it is at all. And the other one was emptiness. That scared the hell out of me. Because this thing about the way I understood it was that nothing exists. Right? So therefore, if nothing exists, then what matters? You know, and that leaves a very, very unpleasant taste in your mouth, you know. And so emptiness doesn't mean that nothing exists. Things just don't exist in the way that we perceive them to be. But things do exist. And so when I began to understand what that was about, and then I realized, then I don't have to be a stoic. I don't have to just sort of like isolate myself and just not really... enjoy the things that I enjoy. Enjoy people, because if I think, well, that nothing exists and that's all impermanent, and they're here with me today and not tomorrow, then why? What does it all matter? Why make relationships? I think we get into that bag sometime. Why even try? You know. And I think that presents a problem. So then we don't have fun, right? And then it becomes just a misery for us. And what the heck is that? You know, I don't want that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you touched on a lot of stuff, so I'll turn it over to Robbie. No, he won't do it. He told me I'm on my own today. I'm going to start off saying something about what Andre said about renunciation and emptiness and all that. Of course, and he's right. You know, emptiness. For those of you who don't really know much about Buddhism, that's how you get out of suffering, ultimately, is to see that things are, that basically we sit right here, all of us are having our own little karmic experience of Sunday morning at Kadampa Center. But we think we're all having the same experience. But no, I'm having mine, and you're having yours, and you're having yours, and you're having yours, and there is no ultimately true Kadampa Center experience. It's just our own version of it. And furthermore, not only are we having our version of it, we believe it. Like, Don Brown is boring. And we believe it. And there's some truth. For you, it's true. You know, somebody else, you think somebody else's thoughts were really good. And for you, that's true. But emptiness is really challenging us to take responsibility for our projections and seeing that they're not, that it's just our projections, that there's no inherently existent out there truth that, you know, that exists independent of my mind. My mind is constantly creating my reality. I believe in it and then I react to it. And that's what creates a lot of problems for me. And then I project a false sense of I, which is the real ultimate, the biggie. You know, we have a strong sense of, as you were saying, a strong sense of self or I. Like when we're experiencing any of these or these. You know, these are the biggies, the things that we all are addicted to, right? And the things that we all feel aversion toward over here. Whenever we have some strong emotional experience, we can see it so clearly. Right now, even now, you can think, okay, my body is sitting and my mind is thinking, where's the I? There seems to be an owner of the body and mind right now, doesn't it? Where is that I? Then you get upset about something and it really gets inflated. That I, the Buddha saw through that. He said, that is a complete fiction. We exist, but not that way. And if we don't see that, we will always, always suffer. So let me move over here to my eight worldly dharmas, which is my favorite teaching in Buddhism, but I sometimes forget it. But it's really important, and it has a lot to do with, I think, what we, you know, when people come in here and they go, well, I have to give up pleasure. I can't go dancing anymore because that brings me pleasure. I can't sing. I can't, you know, I can't take my kids to the beach anymore or Disney World because that's fun. And that's, or I shouldn't get married and have kids because, or go for a job that's going to give me a really good income because somehow that's wrong. I mean, so people go there with their mind thinking that the things that are on the sort of the positive side of the line, and as I mentioned this earlier, Ajahn Buddhadasa, this very great Thai saint, he said it better. He said it really well. He said we're addicted to deliciousness. We're addicted to deliciousness. If we get up in the morning, we want good cup of coffee. We want good conversation. We want a good job with good money, riding to work in a good car. We're addicted to everything. And it's not, you got to hear the word addicted too, because that's different than just we prefer it. You know, having pleasure, you know, a lot of people would say, well, Buddhism's anti-pleasure, right? You go, renunciation, I have to give it all up and become a monk or a nun. You know, you have to, there are no monastics here, so I can say this, but you know, it's like you have to give it up. What Andre's saying is what we need to give up is suffering. You know, renunciation is the determination to be free of suffering. That's what you were renouncing, is suffering and the causes of suffering. It's actually having compassion for ourselves, seeing that with the kind of mind I have, it's not going to look good down the road. I'm caught in this whole process of samsaric uncontrolled causation. It's not going to go well. We all have to deal with that, don't we? We all have to deal with, I mean, there are a lot of young people here, but you're going to get old. If you're lucky enough to live long, you're going to get sick. And we all have to deal with, you know, the end. You know, we're going to deal with that. It's scary because our survival instinct, that's the thing we cling to most. Is me, I. So it's, anyway, it's very interesting. The problem is not the pleasure. Can have all the pleasure we want. It's the problem is the addiction to pleasure. Or the clinging. We use the word clinging a lot. I think that really describes it. It's a sticky, clingy, grasping mind that wants or has more than a casual relationship with pleasure. It has a really unhealthy relationship with pleasurable experiences, be they great food or sexual intimacy or a beautiful sunset or a walk in the woods or whatever it is. As long as we grasp or hang or cling to that experience, first of all, the pleasure we're experiencing is like polluted. Why is it polluted? It's polluted by grasping. So it's not, so we're, yeah, you can call it, we label that pleasure, don't we? But it's really, not the best pleasure. Not the best pleasure. People ask him about Buddhism being against pleasure and against having fun and everything. He said something that's already been said. He said, to the contrary, Buddhism wants us to have the most fun. This is all about having fun. But you want to have fun that's like pure fun, that's blissful, like the greatest possible fun. It was very interesting. When I was first I'm rambling now. I didn't take my Adderall this morning, but anyway. But when I first went to Nepal in the late 70s, most of the people there, in fact, George Chernoff, who was here a few weeks ago, he was there. There were like 200 Westerners, and he came up to me. And I was, at the time, I had been doing my job for a while, and I took a year off to travel and do stuff. And anyway, George Chernoff came up to me and said, almost like, "What are you doing here? You are the straightest person here." Because it was all hippies, you know, who'd come to Nepal for drugs, because you could get anything in Kathmandu for almost nothing. So they came here to get high, and when they heard, this is true, a lot of them heard that these Tibetan lamas could teach you how to get high without drugs. And a lot of them got attracted to, I mean, where it came up to the Copan course, because they wanted to learn how to work with their mind, because they knew that they could experience these extraordinary states of bliss and happiness and joy with drugs, but then, crash. Got to go for another fix. Crash. So it was really unsatisfying. And so a lot of them came up there looking for, like, and then you meet Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa, and they're just laughing and cutting up. You can hear Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa laughing like a half a mile away, you know, because they're sitting up on a hill. And you go, wow, I want what he's got. You know, it was like that. So hundreds and hundreds of people would come up to, you know, to study Buddhism in those early days, really looking for an alternative to drugs. But getting back to the thing of pleasure, Buddhism is not saying that any kind of pleasurable experience, verbal, physical, mental, you know, whatever we call pleasure, it's not bad. But if we cling to it, it just gives us second-rate pleasure. And what does it also do? It creates an aversion to what? The more you crave pleasure, the more you hate what? Pain. And the more you suffer when you get pain. Really? I mean, you see people that are stoic. When they have pain, they deal with it. When they have pleasure, they deal with it. But they don't live for this. But Dachin Buddhadasa says, this is what we live for. And by living for this, we create an aversion to that. So the more we crave, and I'm talking, you want to use the, you know, the term like a craving, like grasping. The more we grasp at pleasure, the more we grasp at not having pain. Another way of saying that is the more we fear pain. The more I crave not having pain, the more I fear pain, right? So when I'm here, I'm not having pain, but I'm not having pleasure, I'm trying to get back over here, and I'm feeling aversion to this, even though I'm not even experiencing it. And when I get over there, it's even worse, right? So the problem is not the pleasure or the pain, because you can't get away from this in life. This is all part of life. We're all going to have pleasurable experiences, and all of us are going to have this, right? And if we crave and cling to not having pain, loss, disgrace, and blame, if we like, I can't stand it if they say anything bad about me, or, you know, if I lose my relationship with my wife or my husband, or my children die, you know, God forbid, or, you know, whatever it is, the more we cling to not having this, the more we suffer when we get it. So it's very interesting. The problem, in a sense, is it possible to be in pain and not suffer? You said, yes, it is possible. Have you actually had that experience?
It's just like complete surrender to pain. It is what it is, so I accept it. I experience it and I accept it. And I pray, if that helps.
Yeah.
So to me personally, acceptance and just having my own values and not having the people pressure that this shouldn't be happening or why did this happen, just have the complete acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
That helps me.
Right. I mean, and having a faith in karma, that whatever the pain that I'm experiencing, even though somebody else crossed the midline and hit me head on and I'm like, you know, sitting up in intensive care unit with all these broken bones, you know, But accepting the pain in that moment is just what it is. It's just a resultant. I'm accepting it. I'm not clean. It's not that we're not trying to get better. If we're in pain, it doesn't mean you don't go to the doctor. If you need to go to the doctor to get some medication to alleviate your pain, if you can't stand it, right? It doesn't mean we don't look for solutions, but it means in the moment of experiencing pain, it's possible to not suffer. If we're not clinging to something, if we're not clinging to pleasure, then pain is what? It's just pain. In fact, there's a meditation that in meditation sometimes it's more done in the Thai tradition than Tibetan Buddhism, but it's called the pain meditation. And you just sit there and you watch your pain in the body. If you sit still for an hour, you will be in terrible pain. Let me tell you, your body will be, you'll be going, this hurts. I hate this. I can't stand it. And the training though is to see it as pain, not identify it as my pain. Okay, pain in the knee, pain in this knee, pain in the neck, thoughts, whatever. But to not identify with the pain is a great way to have a more neutral attitude toward it. Yes, ma'am?
And I also wanted to say that other thing which has helped me personally is to focus on positive. Okay, even if I am in emergency room, I'm blessed to have the capability that I can go to emergency room, have the doctor, have the medicine, and just not be focused on what's wrong, but focus mm-hmm. on what's right.
Mm-hmm. Good. And so that allows you to let go of the attachment to pleasure and to accept the pain. That's what you're saying. So again, so we're talking pleasure, again, the things that we're addicted to, pleasure, all kinds of pleasure, right? Gain, all kinds of gain, material, relationships. The point of this list is this is supposed to subsume everything in the world that you think, that you personally think is delightful and delicious. So it's not inclusive, but fame is a good reputation, so we all want that. We all want to be thought of as being a good person, good at what we do, and then we all want people's approval, don't we? Please like me, Andre. If you don't like me, I just don't think I'm going to be able to. Yeah, oh, please like me. Don't disapprove of me. We walk around like that all the time. We're so addicted to other people's approval. It's ridiculous. And it causes us a lot of suffering. So here we are again. The problem is not this, and even though this is not desirable, I'm not saying that losing your Jaguar or your spouse or your money or your 401k going into the tank, I'm not saying that that's a good thing. It's just what it is. We have to have a more dispassionate attitude toward these things. That's kind of the take-home message, is to let go, to let go, to let go, to let go. Now, how in the world do we do that? How do we let go of our attachment to pleasure and let go of our attachment to not having pain? I mean, that's really that's the question, isn't it?
And you don't have to let go.
Okay. No, you don't have to. You're right. You do not have to.
Right, because I think a lot of people, I think it depends a lot, coming from a different culture or a different country gives you a totally different perspective. If you come to America and you see the way people try to let go, or like you said, people are trying to look nice in front of other people or be something that they're actually not,
mm-hmm.
and it's a cultural thing. So I think the same with letting go, trying to let go, trying to not do this. It's like you said, very clingy.
Right.
Everyone tries to cling to either pleasure or pain and missing actually what's, I think, just the peace of being in the moment. And just not your example was very interesting, and I may take a little long, but I'm going to try to make it short. We recently just had a baby a month ago. So
mm-hmm.
from my previous experience, I had low platelets. I couldn't have the epidural. I went through a very, very long delivery and very painful. So in my mind, I was very stressed about that. And I was trying with my second baby not to get there. So I had this fear. I was in a constant fear that I'm going to go through the same thing and it's going to be horrible. Instead of letting go and just living with the idea that it might happen, I dragged it and it came. I was in the same exact situation like 7 years ago when a month before I had the baby, I was told, we're sorry, your platelets are very low. Unless we're going to be able to raise them, we're not going to be able to do anything for you. You're going to have to deliver the same way. So from that moment till I delivered, I did everything possible to raise my platelets. I went to this doctor, to that doctor. You know, my fear took control. And instead of just dealing with the present and with the fact that I'm going to, you know, just have the baby, I put my body and my mind to this whole stress where I was taking steroids. They, you know, every doctor was giving. Now suddenly they discovered that there's something with the thyroid. So I went through the whole thing mentally knowing I was not going to change anything, but still putting pressure on myself, on the baby, and still I had the same delivery. I still couldn't take the epidural. The steroids couldn't. Yeah. But what you were saying somehow brought those memories back to me, and it kind of I think, because it also matters a lot whether or not you're a sick person or a healthy person. So I think not everybody's, you know, I see my mother-in-law. She's a sick type of person. And I mean, not type of person. She's been sick since she was a kid. And you can see how her whole presence and her whole attitude towards life and towards just general things that you're talking about is a completely different thing, because she says, well, how can I can't enjoy life. In our country, people who are over 50 or 60 are almost like, yeah, well, our life is done. You know, I mean, this is, you know, women cook the whole day. That it's not about traveling anymore. It's about working.
Going back to your and I know we're going to have to wrap it up, I guess. My Fitbit doesn't tell me what time it is, but I'm just listening to you, and I'm not disagreeing with you that I don't think we have to let go. We don't have to let go. We don't have to let go of our attachment to pleasure, and we don't have to let go of our aversion to pain. Buddhism is not saying we have to do that. But it's very clear logically, and I think if we check our experience, for example, clinging to having a painless delivery would create a lot of aversion to having a painful delivery more suffering.
Right.
So, you know, Buddhism's not saying that we have to let go. It's not saying we can do all of these things and still cling. But the consequences of that is always going to be suffering. It's always going to be suffering. And we can go through life feeling aversion toward this, and the consequence is always going to be suffering. If we want to have a happy life, then it behooves us to try to develop and train ourselves to recognize when we're clinging, and try to infuse that moment with wisdom, which would allow us to let go, and compassion too. Compassion for ourselves, compassion for other people. And so we have to sort of, it's not an easy process. I mean, this is like the work of, this teaching is called the eight worldly dharmas sometimes. And I can tell you, this is where we spend this is our whole life right here. You know, clinging to to deliciousness and being fearful and dreading and feeling aversion toward things that aren't good. And Buddhism is really trying to teach us how to live in the moment, accept whatever comes up as just a resultant of our own karma, and then to infuse our awareness of that with wisdom and compassion. That is not easy. That's a work of many lifetimes. But that's kind of where we have to leave it today, to be continued. I think I've just been... Sarah's given me the... time. So do you want to speak now? We did the dedication. Okay, go ahead.
So, my name is Sarah, and I am here talking to you today to tell you about an incredibly special event that's happening this coming weekend. We are having a relic tour coming. It's called the Maitreya Loving Kindness Tour. And it's a tour of the relics of the Holy Buddha and many of the holy masters. It's something that is incredibly profound. The people who have experienced it before use words like life-changing. So it's something that we really encourage you to come check out. It's all weekend, Friday night, Saturday all day, Sunday all day. There's no teachings on Sunday morning because of this special tour. You can also bring your pets for special blessings. So they can come, they can circumambulate the stupa, come inside and circumambulate the relics, get a bonk on the head from the reliquary. So it's really a meaningful thing you can do for your animals as well. Kids, everyone's welcome. There's no charge. But we're also desperately in need of volunteers. And it takes our whole community to put this on because we need 150 shifts, 2 to 3 hour shifts, to cover that whole weekend. And I've still got probably at least 60 more 2 to 3 hour shifts that I've got to fill before the weekend. So I'm sitting in the lobby so that I can answer your questions about what each shift is that's available, what does it mean, what do I have to do, and I can help you sign up. So please come see me in the lobby if you can help out this coming weekend. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. Thank you, everyone, for your attention and the contribution. It's, you know, again, more questions than answers, but that's fine. I mean, you know, to sort of to live in that question of how can I, is this fun experience really as much fun as I thought it was? Or can I make this fun experience like the cause for me to get enlightened? Can I make it, you know, like if I have some kind of joyful experience, you know, can I like offer that joy and happiness to others, you know, to the gurus, to the enlightened beings? And I'm gonna have as much fun as I can, and I'm gonna give all the pleasure and all the joy to the gurus. What a great, you know, then you're not just, your ego's not so tied up in it, maybe. So there's a lot of techniques to transform even pleasurable experiences into the cause for enlightenment. All right, so we're going to do the dedication prayers starting on 246. This is Shanti Deva's prayer, and this one is His Holiness the Dalai Lama really likes this one, and so that's, we like it too. May all beings everywhere, plagued by the sufferings of body and mind, attain a notion of happiness enjoyed by virtue of my merit. May no living creature suffer from evil or ever fall ill with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May the timely rains and bountiful harvests, may all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be free from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains and as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Now let's get back to the beginning on the just the continuation. The next page, I guess it's 36. We can do these long life, these, maybe do these two pages of dedication, prayers, and so forth. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. all-powerful Chenrezig, Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold its doer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers, honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And we could do Mi'kmaq Tsewe. Let's do that one. We'll do the five line one even, in Tibetan. Mi'kmaq Tsewe Techen Chen Rezig Dri Megyampe Wampo Jambayan Dupun Malu Chonse Sanwedan Kanchen Kape Zugyan Zongkapa Lodzan Drape Shabla Sowadeb. Now the Four Measurables in Tibetan. I don't know the tune of that. Well, I'll try. Who knows the Tibetan tune? Robbie? Sen chan dan che de wa dan de we gyu dan dam ba gyu jik du nyao dan du gyao gi gyu dan dre wa gyu jik du nyao me pe pe wa dan mi dre wa gyu jik ne ring cha dan ni dan dre we dan yom la ne pa gyu jik. Okay, so we do Omani Pimiyam. Anybody want to help me with the tune to that one? Otherwise, I'll do my tune. Mani Padme Hum, Oh 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 Mani Padme Hum. Dari tu dari tu re so ha hum 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 dari tu dari tu re so ha Om Dari Tu Dari Tu Re So Ha. Okay, thank you.